I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Tobias Wolff went to prep school. Of that, there is no doubt. Only one who has lived in that strange and secluded world of cloisters and classrooms and class could as accurately describe the sound of a boy's dorm with 50 different records playing at once, doors slamming, loud voices in long hallways, and the faint hiss of many showers all running together. Tobias Wolff demonstrated this skill of description in his prize-winning memoir, This Boy's Life. Now he's back with a novel that picks up where the memoir left off. In this case, Wolff draws us into thinking about lying, about using lies to construct an identity, how everything we think and say we are but are not in our teenage years, and how that shapes who we become as adults. And that's where you can join us today. How much do we actually construct our identity as teenagers? How much of what we are as adults is built on those lies or twisted truths or misapprehensions from the years when we're younger? Can a writer take us back into that kind of self-examination? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tobias Wolff is my guest this hour. His new book is called Old School. He's joining us from a studio in Stanford, California. It's nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Tobias, I suspect you had some fun writing this book in If Only, I was going to say, because it gives you a chance to talk about the way that one writer can love the work of another writer.
Absolutely. And that was a guiding passion for me when I was younger. It was one of my pole stars, that love of writing and adulation of writers, sometimes unreasonable adulation of writers, especially I think of my passion for Ayn Rand, which I'm afraid lasted a little longer than my narrators. But that was the great fun of writing the novel as well, was the chance to immerse myself in the work of these three visiting writers, Ayn Rand, Robert Frost, and Ernest Hemingway, and also in their letters, which I loved reading, gave me a sense of the way their minds turned in certain situations, and gave me a chance really to learn how to impersonate them, which all three appear as characters in the novel.
Now, for the people who haven't read it, there's a competition in Old School. Maybe you can just explain how it works.
Sure. The boys in this school, the boys in their last year, the seniors, or sixth formers as they're called at the school, in this kind of Anglophilic tradition that they observe. The boys compete for private audiences with the three writers who visit the school each year by submitting a piece of work, fiction if the visitor is a novelist, poetry if the visitor is a poet. The best examples of the students' work are sent to the writers, who then choose one of them. That piece is then published in the school newspaper, and then later a picture of the young writer walking the headmaster's garden with the famous writer, the luminary who visits, receiving the laying on of hands and sage advice about the writing life. And, you know, when you're at that age, those things mean so much to you. You'll do almost anything to have a crack at being alone with Ernest Hemingway. And, you know, unfortunately, our narrator does do almost anything.
We'll get to that in a minute. I wonder if I can ask you to read us a paragraph where you're describing these trophy meetings, as you call them. I'm not sure if you've got the page there. It's early in the book.
Sure.
I think page 7. Have you got it there, Tobias?
Uh-huh. Sure. The particular passage that you're referring to here, I'm not exaggerating the importance to us of these trophy meetings. We cared, and I cared as much as anyone, because I not only read writers, I read about writers. I knew that Maupassant, whose stories I loved, had been taken up when young by Flaubert and Turgenev, Faulkner by Sherwood Anderson, Hemingway by Fitzgerald and Pound and Gertrude Stein. All of these writers were welcomed by other writers. It seemed to follow that you needed such a welcome, yet before this could happen, you somehow, anyhow, had to meet the writer who was to welcome you. My idea of how this worked wasn't low or even practical. I never thought about making connections. My aspirations were mystical. I wanted to receive the laying on of hands that had written living stories and poems, hands that had touched the hands of other writers. I wanted to be anointed.
Tobias Wolff reading from his new book, Old School. Now, there's a part of the book where you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds as much like the voice of Tobias Wolff as the voice of our unnamed narrator.
Well, sure. There's no question at all that in writing this book, I drew very heavily on my own experiences, though they're more the internal experiences that I recall than the external experiences, if I could put it that way. Mm-hmm. That is, a lot of the events in the novel are purely invented. But my response to that atmosphere of privilege and that very rarefied intellectual kind of enterprise that was so remarkable in my experience, having come from Concrete High School in Concrete, Washington, this was something that made a tremendous impression on me at the time. I could even say kind of shocked me in some ways, and I've mulled it over ever since. And so I was trying to find events that would in some way most vividly illustrate that that shock to the spirit and that way in which a young person in formation tries to find true north to in an alien land and to find a path that makes sense, to find oneself, in fact, and one's own essential being.
In a way, Tobias, too, you have to kind of grab us by the elbows to point us in this direction. I want to tell you about something that I did in just getting ready for the interview. I thought to myself, man, 13, 14, 15-year-old boys at a prep school, they weren't really worshiping writers. They're listening to music. They're hanging out, watching movies. And so I went back to a book I've got called Timelines of History, which, you know, says this is what's going on in 1960 and 61. And I come across top songs like Itsy Bitsy, Teeny Weeny, Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, and Love Makes the World Go Round. I'm going, no, nobody was listening to that stuff. But then I look at who was writing what at that time, and the list of authors is stunning. You know, Steinbeck, yeah, and Updike and Vidal and Lee and Pinter and Stone and Heller and Hess. These people were all writing while you were at high school.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not a part of life as we know it today. In a way, we've passed that in a way, haven't we?
I'm afraid we have. A friend of mine once told me, should is the killer word in the English language because it's the most ineffectual word. Things happen as they will. Obviously, the season has turned in some way. And it is certainly the case that, you can't be crying over the past. But it was a vital literary culture at the time ways that it probably really isn't anymore. Not that there isn't a tremendous robustness to American writing right now. I mean, I think of Donna Tartt, and I think of Jeffrey Eugenides and Jonathan Franzen, mm-hmm, and the young writers coming up now are tremendously powerful. Certainly writers of my own generation are. There's never been a time when American writing hasn't been vital since Washington Irving. We have a great deal to be proud of in this. But the fascination of the young with writers probably is not nearly as powerful now as it was when I was a boy. That's true. But you know, you can love Ayn Rand and still love it was Yellow, Itsy Beanie, Tiny Polka Dot Bikini, because I did.
Let's talk about identity, though. You made that kind of tectonic shift from concrete high school to the Hill School in Pennsylvania. You write about it in This Boy's Life, and how at that time you sort of had to, well, you completely constructed an identity for yourself in order to get into the school. That's a story we know. But in this book, Old School, you take that a little bit further in terms of the way that people go on to construct themselves. What were you thinking?
We are self-conscious as people. That's just an inescapable part of our nature. It's the humanness of our nature. And that means that I think especially when we're young, we're performing animals. We kind of, even as we are ourselves, we're watching ourselves, and we're watching how what we do affects other people, and we are adjusting our performance constantly to achieve desired results. It's natural. I think we do it almost instinctively. And there's a part that imagination plays in this. You can't be who you can't imagine being. You can only be that person you can imagine being. So in a sense, you're casting yourself in different roles. You're your own director, your own writer, your own producer when you're young. And you keep doing this until you wear the role so naturally that you forget you're performing. But there is a tremendous amount of, I think, self-consciousness in the that goes into the creation of a person. Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful line in Gregor von Rotzori's book, Memoirs of an Anti-Semite, in which he says, "I make myself up, therefore I am," which is a very different take than Pascal's. I liked that. I thought, yes, this acknowledges the part of that the kind of creative impulse in us plays in making us who we are.
And does that mean then that what is made up isn't necessarily a lie if it then ends up being who you are and who you become?
Absolutely. I think we have no choice. It's not we have to choose to be someone, and you know, the kind of person we choose to be will eventually, that choice will vanish as a kind of conscious will, because we'll be so accustomed to playing the role that it will no longer seem a role. You know, how can we tell the dancer from the dance after a while? But there is definitely an element in our coming to be who we are of choice and performance, I think.
The fascinating thing is, Connection listeners, that as Tobias Wolff so elegantly shows us in his new novel, Old School, the choices that he's talking about, those things that mark our identity for our entire life, are choices that we make when we're 13, 14, and 15 years old. I'm interested in knowing whether or not you can look back that far and see the way that you put yourself together, or whether or not the guidance of a writer can show you that. Our number here is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, we are talking with Tobias Wolff, author of This Boy's Life and a brand new novel called Old School. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Tobias Wolff. We're talking about his new book, Old School. Tobias, something I wanted to ask you to take us a little bit further on. When you did go yourself to prep school and you became passionate about literature, was that in a way your attempt to take a kind of middle class background and give you standing in an upper class society?
It must have been. I didn't even have a middle class background to fall back on.
Okay,
I don't know what I had, but I will say that in all honesty, my love of writing and reading preceded my coming to this school. In fact, it was probably how I got into the school. But it became very, very conscious when I arrived there. And partly it was a snobbery, I think, because the masters that we all looked up to most were the English masters. And the great events on the campus were the visits of these writers every year. And so it was in the air. There's no question about it. But I loved reading and I loved writing. And I'm not sure exactly whether I could have articulated this to myself at the time or not, but it certainly, instinctively, I think I understood, and that writers or the writing life appeared to me anyway to offer an escape from this kind of class-ridden world that I found myself in the oppressions of class, that writers seemed to me to form some kind of class of their own. They lived, it seemed, very independently of the usual hierarchies and social considerations. And this was a very alluring idea to me. It offered you both a vocation and an escape from what seemed to me kind of quotidian considerations, you know, the 9-to-5, the 50-week-a-year job, and at the same time, you know, the whole the competition implied by a class system of which I'd really been fairly unaware until I got to this place. So it was an out in a million ways, and it was an out that really appealed to me because I loved what it involved, which was writing and reading.
You do this fabulous job, I have to say, of taking us back into what it's like to consider ourselves at that age. I see myself. I remember things that I experienced in the way that I related to, you know, peers at age 15 and 16.
Oh, God.
I wonder if you can flip to page 108, where you talk about the way that you find your place there. It's where you start talking about getting the scholarship to Columbia University. Do you see that reading?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd been awarded a full scholarship to Columbia University to work with Lionel Trilling, as I liked to think, and often told myself. An essay I'd written on Shakespeare's sonnet number 29, When in Disgrace with Fortune and Men's Eyes, had just won the Cassidy English Prize, a great stroke of luck. 5 weeks at a summer program in Oxford, all expenses paid. My classmates liked me, most of them, and a few of the younger boys paid me a kind of puppyish attention that I recognized from my own early days when some upperclassman caught my eye. And why would I catch a new boy's eye? Maybe because from my own anxious studies I had made myself the picture of careless gentility, ironically cordial when not distracted, hair precisely unkempt, shoes down at heel, clothes rumpled and frayed to perfection. This was the sort of figure I'd been drawn to almost from the beginning. It had somehow suggested sailing expertise, Christmas in St. Anton, inherited box seats, and an easy disregard for all that. By going straight to the disregard, I'd hoped to imply the rest. I had also meant to wipe out any trace of the public school virtues, sharpness of dress, keenness of manner, spanking cleanliness, freshness, niceness, sincerity I used to cultivate. By now I'd been so far absorbed into my performance that nothing else came naturally. But I never quite forgot that I was performing. In the first couple of years there'd been some spirit of play in creating the part, refining it, watching it pass. There'd been pleasure in implying a personal history through purely dramatic effects of manner and speech without ever committing an expository lie, and pleasure in doubleness itself. There was more to me than people knew. All that was gone. When I caught myself in the act now, I felt embarrassed. It seemed a stale, conventional role, and 4 years of it had left me a stranger even to those I called my friends. I wanted out. That was partly why I'd chosen Columbia. I liked how the city seethed up against the school, mocking its theoretical seclusion with hustle and noise, the din of people going and getting and making. Things that mattered at Princeton or Yale couldn't possibly withstand this battering of raw, unironic life. You didn't go to eating clubs at Columbia. You went to jazz clubs. You had a girlfriend. No, a lover, with psychiatric problems and friends with foreign accents. You read newspapers on the subway and looked at tourists with a cool, anthropological gaze. You said, Crosstown Express. You said, The Village. You ate weird food. No other boy in my class would be going there.
That's Tobias Wolff reading from his new novel, Old School. And I can go so far, listeners, as to tell you that the narrator in Old School, in pursuing the competition to spend time with one of the writers, plagiarizes someone else's story and in an attempt to win an audience with Ernest Hemingway. And Tobias, when your young writer breaks that horrible rule of stealing someone else's work, do you think that he is seeing that as just another step in devising an image with, you know, hair precisely unkempt and clothes frayed to perfection?
No, oddly enough, what the narrator is doing there is he has become so fed up with this performance, as he's just described mm-hmm. it here, that he's really thinking he's telling the truth about himself. He discovers a story quite by accident, written by a woman at a girls' school some 5 years earlier in a journal, one of the literary journals that happens to be around in the storehouse of their own literary journal, that so accurately describes his own soul to him and his own pretenses that it seems to be his own story to him. And to acknowledge it seems to him at that moment to be an act of truth-telling and confession almost. Of course, his own motives are obscure to him. He hardly is aware how much he wants to win this audience with Hemingway. And how much that's acting on him. What he thinks he's doing, though, is telling the truth about himself in an odd way. In a way, he's too good a reader. What any writer wants to do is to make the reader feel. I was very gratified, for example, a moment ago when you said that in reading my book, you had felt that in some way I was telling your story. And that is exactly what every writer wants to create in the reader, is the sense that, oh, my God, this is my story. This writer is telling my story. And I have had that experience. I mean, that has drawn me in so often. And I'm not just talking about the circumstances of a life. That's easy. I have had that experience, for example, in reading Jane Austen. In reading, Persuasion or Pride and Prejudice, and she renders so truthfully the soul of another person that it becomes recognizable to me in some way as my own. Dickens does that. The beginning of Great Expectations, the picture of Pip out on the moors, wandering on this Christmas day, escaping the stifling presence of his sister and his scolding sister, and being out on his own, but being cold, and the disjunction between the cold and the bleakness, and yet what is supposed to be the holiday. Who has not felt that? And so he invites you, he brings you into the world. It's easier with something like Catcher in the Rye or Huckleberry Finn, obviously.
This isn't very simple. What you're saying is that there is truth in taking someone else's words and absorbing them and saying, hey, that is my story.
Exactly. And the problem is that in this, how can I put it, this creative fusion between the reader and the writer, this unbelievably intimate relationship that goes on in a good piece of writing with a good reader, is that sometimes the sense of the boundary between them can disappear. And I'm not talking about the kind of plagiarism of the careerist at a newspaper who simply wants to get ahead and is cutting corners, or some kid grubbing a grade in a writing class. I'm talking about this disappearance of the distinction between the fact that, yes, this is your story, but you didn't actually write it, you know. And it happens. I think it's an extraordinarily subtle psychological moment in a person's life when that happens. It's both wonderful and kind of terrifying, because your own boundaries vanish then.
These are some of the ways that we help construct our own identity. As we were talking earlier in the program, there are the many different notions and ideas that we have as teenagers that are either outright lies or simply misguided notions that help us shape an identity. And that's very much at the heart of Tobias Wolff's new book, Old School. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Let's go to Harvard now, Massachusetts, and Kathleen's joining us. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for putting the show on the air. I wanted to call because not only do I admire the work of Tobias Wolff greatly, but for the last several months, I've been working with about 100 students from urban areas and rural areas around the country, teenagers, on a book in which they talk directly about the role of adults in their lives as they themselves reach to develop their own identities.
What are they saying about where they get their ideas?
Well, these are kids that are that are largely without privilege in school and work settings where adults may be largely unavailable to them as role models, rather where the adults tend to operate more in the role of controller or even oppressor, one might say, where zero tolerance is kind of more the modus operandi than dialogue or coaching. And that sets up this situation where kids largely won't talk to adults, and adults are, in fact, afraid to really talk to kids or serve in the kind of mentoring.
So they build their identity how then, Kathleen?
Well, what they've been telling me in these hundreds of hours of conversation is that they do, in fact, look to adults, but that they're asking adults to, in a way, play on the level with them and open up to them as much as they open up to each other. They find their identity anywhere they can, with each other, with media figures, things like that. Mm-hmm. I've had kids tell me that, oh, I want to be like Bill O'Reilly because he really knows what he's talking about and he really stands for something. I've had kids tell me, oh, I want to be like Kobe Bryant because, you know, he's really a good guy. But in general, what they hunger for is finding role models with the adults that are actually in their lives. And many of them, if they're lucky enough to find a position where an adult will talk to them and openly and not as a controller.
This is in many ways, Kathleen, where Tobias takes us in. And Tobias, help me with this. In the relationship between the students and the professors or the teachers at the prep school who have something to contribute to their lives. Because that's the only contact they get, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And to some extent, the boys in the school bring each other up. The adults are there, and but they're not open personally. Their leadership is intellectual and to some extent moral, and in ways that make the boys idealize them, of course. And part of what this novel does is to show that these adults are just as fumbling and lost in many ways and searching for meaning as the kids are, though they feel they have to keep this front up. And I remember when This Boy's Life was coming out, one of my great fears about publishing that book, we have three children, and we had two teenage sons at the time in their early teens, and I was rather worried about exposing my early peccadilloes and inventions and misdeeds to boys that I would actually have to in some way hold up
be accountable to, yeah.
Yeah, be account, you know, and I had to discipline them occasionally and that sort of thing. And where was my authority going to come from? And of course, that was ridiculous. It really freed us up tremendously. They could see me as someone who was as human as they, who had in fact fumbled his own way through things and had been infinitely more confused than they were at that age. And it put it, you know, it made us great friends, actually.
How do you reconcile, though, what seems to be kind of a contradiction? And that is that you acknowledge implicitly that the prep school is a very weird place, particularly an all-boys prep school. And yet it was something that was, you know, sort of deeply affecting and formative for you.
Oh, absolutely. Nothing is any one thing. I'm not nostalgic for that world. I mean, it was extremely insular and somewhat misogynistic and certainly very class-ridden, all that sort of thing. But at the same time, there was a tremendous intensity of comradeship. There was an intellectual vitality and an intellectual austerity even to the whole project of learning there. There was an intellectual excitement. And so all that, you know, I'm grateful for every moment I spent there, and also in awakening me to the fact of class. I mean, mm-hmm. It was just it's something that I never really saw before. I had an intellectual idea of it, but not the experience of it, and it really was an awakening for me.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like you to join our conversation. Question for you: how much do we actually construct our identity as teenagers, and how much of then what we end up as adults is built on the sort of lies and twisted truths from the years when we are much younger? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. These questions are at the very heart of a new novel by Tobias Wolff. It's called Old School. He's my guest this hour, and we're welcoming your calls when we come back right after the break. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Tobias Wolff is our guest this hour. He is the award-winning short story writer who has just published his first novel. It's called Old School. A lot of people will know Tobias for his memoir, This Boy's Life. He's also a three-time winner of the O. Henry Award for short fiction, won the Penn Faulkner Award for The Barracks Thief, and has been teaching at the Stanford Creative Writing Program since 1997. He's joining us in the studios from Stanford. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. We're going to go next to Raleigh, North Carolina. Press is joining us on the line. Hi, Press. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I got Old School for Christmas and read it almost immediately and enjoyed it immensely. And what I was interested in, and frankly been puzzling about for the last week or so, was how the reference at the very end of the book, I think it was even the last sentence of the book, to the parable of the prodigal son relates to the themes of the book that Mr. Wolff has been discussing, and to his writings generally.
These are the sort of themes, Press, that have to do with people who leave a school under questionable or disgraceful circumstances and then come back.
Well, partly that, and you know, partly these issues of identity that you've talked about, and I'm interested in understanding the interplay because I've really been puzzling about that since I finished the book last week.
Okay, there you go, Tobias.
Well, and I'll try to keep it brief. It seems to me that the narrator of this, the part of what the narrator of this novel is doing and seeking this laying on of hands, this anointing, is searching for some kind of blessing from a father. He has obviously his mother has died. He has a very troubled relationship with his own father, mainly his own fault. He sees his father as weak, as giving in to grief over the mother's death, grief with which he himself is almost too resolutely refusing to feel. And so he looks for it in the masters around him and in the writers around him who come. It's this search for the Father and for some recognition. And and each of these, each of the writers, and finally the master he most looks up to, is seen finally in the novel as being as human and failed as himself. And I think in that recognition there is the kind of coming home. There is the there, you know, the yes, it does end with a line from the parable of the prodigal son, and there is a sense of acceptance, and I think also self-acceptance in that conclusion. That's, and writing, of course, plays a part in that as well.
When you talk, Press, I'll come back to you in just half a sec, but just a clarification here, Tobias. When you talk about the young person looking for some kind of approval, if we go back to where we were talking earlier in the mm-hmm. program about the way that person constructs an identity, is it sort of like gathering all the strings to reeds together and then looking around for someone who'll say, yeah, that works, or that is
yeah,
an identity?
Sure. Yes, and finally being able to feel that about oneself as well, to perhaps to stop asking the question is finally to accept what it is you finally become.
Press, does that help you out at all?
That helps me. That helps me very much. And one of the things that I was considering is whether this would be an appropriate book, and I only mean appropriate in the sense of would she understand it, for my own 14-year-old who's not that much younger than the narrator. I really wonder whether a person coming at it at that age could really understand enough about these themes and issues to really make it a worthwhile read for them. And I've been kind of puzzling that out as well.
My guess is I think I would have enjoyed this novel as a boy of your daughter's age. I'm not sure I would have understood it really. My guess, it certainly wasn't intended for a young adult audience. It was, or older children. It was very much conceived of as an adult novel, and I think perhaps you have had to live a little while to feel whatever truths I may have been able to arrive at in this book.
Except that when we think about books that stick with us, books that we might go back and reread, we may have read when we're 14 a story by Hemingway that means something quite different to us when we're 40 years old.
No, that's exactly right. Yes, exactly.
Right. Press, thanks for your call. Next to Weston, Massachusetts, Todd's on the line with us. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm just so excited to hear you discussing the possibility that a work of plagiarism or an act of plagiarism copying another person's work is something that we might not ought to dismiss so readily, that perhaps it's...
Todd, your line is breaking up on us there. I'm afraid we lost you at the tail end.
I do catch the thread of what Todd is saying, though. I think that the... You know, in the latest sort of hot media cases of plagiarism, a certain kind of vision of what it is has emerged. But I think there's something else that goes on here that is that's very much bound up with our capacity to empathize, to enter in imaginatively into the lives of others, and also with imitation. We learn everything in our lives by imitation. From the moment we begin to speak our first word and to get the idea of standing upright on two legs rather than crawling around on four, all that is done by imitation. And when we first begin writing, we write like the people that we admire. There's no other way to learn. And so these two capacities or inclinations of imitation and of the capacity for empathy and leaving oneself behind to enter another, these two things can sometimes come together in an unfortunate way, or a way that begins fortunately and ends up with somewhat catastrophic results for us. And so I find it a much more interesting kind of phenomenon, the whole thing, than one would ever guess from reading the latest expose.
Okay, but you're helping young writers try and make sense of this as a professor, Tobias. How do you make the connection between what's acceptable and the sort of public spanking that someone like Doris Kearns Goodwin is going to get in terms of you know, where you can borrow from, what you can use, that sort of thing?
Well, I think in the case, I mean, I know that I don't want to go.
I was just using her as an example. But
sure, no. And that's more the careerist kind of thing that I was talking about. Well, that's a very interesting question. Now, if I got a story, in fact, to tell you the truth, I myself have never had a story handed in to me that I believe was plagiarized. Maybe I've been hoodwinked, but I don't think so.
I really don't. It's a little harder to download creative writing off the net.
Yeah, it isn't the kind of people who would take my class just probably wouldn't be interested in doing that too much. But what I have had are stories that borrow very heavily in technique or voice or even the picture of a particular world from some work that I'm familiar with. And what I would then say to the young writer, what I do say is, I really love the way you have picked up I want them to recognize that I see what they've done, but I don't want to make them embarrassed about it. Because I think it's so, I did it myself. I think it's so much a part of learning to write, that if you do it well, if you can mimic well, that you ought to be congratulated for it. And at the same time, be aware that you haven't quite arrived at your own voice and vision yet. And so, you know, it's a delicate, you don't want to be a scold about these things. Now, if I caught somebody just flat out taking something word for word without the change of a comma, if I caught them, I would come down on them like a ton of bricks for that. I've never done that in my life. Right. And I wouldn't tolerate it in another, but I can secretly understand how it would happen.
1-800-423-8255. Next to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And Duffy is joining us. Hi, Duffy.
Hello, Dick. You and I met when you were down here visiting WUNC.
Well, thanks for calling.
And what I would call myself a recovering private boarding school student from long ago. I went for 5 years. And I was just curious, from the author's point of view, do you still find it difficult to sort of assimilate your life into more normal, you know, the normal way we think about life as it was affected by boarding school experience? Overeducated, not having the social experiences that one had in public schools and so on. I was there from 8th grade through 12th, or from second form through 6th form, as we called it.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Well, yes, you have obviously some post-traumatic stress issues here to deal with. But, you know, I was there for less time than you, and I did, in fact, go to a public high school for a while. So, you know, our situations were very different, I think. And also, I went straight from my school. I got kicked out over academic failures, lost my scholarship and had to leave in my last year, and went right into the Army, where I spent 4 years. And that was, for me, actually, in many ways, as formative an experience as the school. So I had a lot of things going on in my life that gave me somewhat insanely balanced.
I was going to say balancing stress with stress here.
Balancing one crazy world with another. But it nevertheless taught me to stay on my feet, I think. And right. So, no, I have, honestly, as I said, that school was a rescue for me. I was in an abysmal school and where I was learning nothing and had very little hope of learning anything. As challenging in many ways and as odd as this world was, it was a wonderful experience for me. It gave me a life in many ways that I think I probably wouldn't have had otherwise.
Let's go to Durham, North Carolina now. Misha's joining us now. Hi, Misha.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for waiting.
My question is about the end of the book. The last 20 to 25 pages are really about this character who has played kind of a peripheral role up until that point, and it gave the book a very kind of unpredictable and non-linear quality. I'm just wondering if you could talk about that choice.
For those who haven't read it, is the jump from the story of the narrator to the story of the dean at the school who is discovered.
Well,
go ahead, Toby.
Yeah, sure. Well, to begin with, this is not... He, the narrator, don't forget, is telling this story himself on on very little evidence. He's had about a 10-minute conversation with another master about the events that he's describing here, and so it's mostly made up by him, in fact. The main events are not, but the what happened is not, but the sense of the person's character and how he bore up under this consciousness of duplicity and deception all these years. That's straight from the narrator. So what I'm saying here is that when someone tells a story like this, they're really talking about themselves. And he is describing his own laboring under this sense of falseness and duplicity and doubleness there, and his kind of coming to terms with it. He's telling it through the medium of another person's story, but that's what writers do. And this is a narrator, if you look back through the novel, who always tells his own story through someone else's, as he did when he plagiarized that woman's story. So I think it's very consistent with him psychologically to adopt another person's story and use it to tell his own. And at the same time, it is true about this master as well, and it throws another light about the world of adults that he has been so somewhat starstruck by when he's younger.
Misha, thanks for the call, and Tobias, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us on The Connection.
I enjoyed it.
Tobias Wolff's new novel is called Old School. The Connection is produced by Khalil Bird, Nancy Cohen, Catherine Fenollosa, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Jennifer Giles, Sarah Ligon, and Matt Miller. You can find our website at www.theconnection.org. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.